Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch."
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad,
a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news.
We're watching.
Fashion trends. Pep talks where we give advice.
Mental health moments.
And games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame. Martin Glover, or as he's better known, Youth, is one of the most prolific producers of our time. He's still, however, probably best known for being the bassist of Killing Joke, though he left the band in 1982 after just a few years and before they achieved mainstream success, though he did, however, return in 1994. In the first part of this interview, I talked to the man who has been consistently part of new creative styles in music, from dub funk to industrial techno and psychedelic trance, about his early life.
So Youth, Martin Glover, welcome. I want to start with something that, I mean, it is your early age, and I know you've talked about your boarding school a lot, but I want to go even back even further and just find out whether your parents were musical in any way, or what sort of music they listened to, or were they even culturally interested, and what, you know, how you grew up very young.
Okay, so, yeah, good question. My parents weren't musical, but they love music. So I was born in 1960. I was born in Nairobi, Kenya, but I left very quickly. My father met my mother doing his national service. He's Welsh. She's fifth generation white, colonial, Scottish. And they thought they'd have a better life in the UK as the country went into independence, and to give me and my sister British passport. So I spent 2 years with my grandmother, with my sister, while my parents found their feet up in Birmingham. So I remember music up there a bit. But actually my first memories of music was when I was living with my parents in a little village called Stoke Poges, just outside Slough. And it was probably 1967. My father would bring back albums now and again and play them. But one day he brought back Sgt. Pepper's. And I was immediately drawn to the sleeve, took out the inner bag, cut out the moustache and stuck it on my jumper, and then played the record incessantly. And that's a very vivid memory. And I remember that was just a portal to another dimension. I just loved it. But, you know, this was 1967. My parents didn't really take drugs, but they were a very young, beautiful couple. My mother was a model. She was one of the fairy liquid girls on TV. I actually did a few ads with her, one for British Rail and one for Outline Margarine, I remember. And she drove a red Mini Cooper S. And my dad was a bit fly. He was a bit of a villain, really, except he wasn't violent, but he would run dodgy laundrettes and cigarette machine operations. And he was in and out of prison. And but he was very charming, very good looking, and he was a lover of life. He was a real hedonist for the good things in life. Come his mother and his family, very working class, very poor in Birmingham. And so he was, you know, really grabbing life by the throat and enjoying it. Problem was he drank a bit too much, you know. But I remember going to parties around Slough in the 60s. And these beautiful women and everybody having a great time. And I'd be in someone's living room. I'd find the record player and I'd put on a single. I don't know, it could be Sugar Sugar, any of those singles. I'd just play it to death, get the tennis racket out and start, you know, miming along in front of the mirror. Those were my formative experiences. And that carried on till the early 70s. And I think the one that really kicked in for me was, the first single I ever bought, David Essex, Rock On. I played that to death. And then Gary Glitter, Rock and Roll Part 2. Now, I must have been about 11 then.
Did they want you to go to boarding school? You said your father was in prison a lot. It sounds like maybe it was difficult to bring up a child alone for your mother. I don't know. Did they want you to go to boarding school? Was it for you a choice?
Yeah, it was very difficult for my mother. She had my sister and me. And often when my father did come back, he'd go into these sloughs of depression and, you know, walk around the house in a dressing gown all day and run up debts and send me and my sister to go and talk to the bailiff and say, Daddy wasn't in. I mean, looking back, it was a bit tough. And I can tell it was very tough for my mother. But nevertheless, he was very charming. He'd leave a diamond ring in the washing up club for her and things like that. Very romantic. But yeah, I think around 8, they were getting divorced and separated. And I was sent to a weekly boarding school in Slough, right by the tracks, LVS. And I quite enjoyed that, although I'd come back home at the weekends and then my mum would drive me back Sunday night and she'd always have the radio on as she drove me back, and it would be, I think after the chart rundown, it'd go to the King's Singers and it'd be Sing Something Simple, the soporific choir stuff. And it just made me feel really depressed going back to school. But I got on with it. I quite enjoyed it. I remember infesting the whole school with pet mice that I brought in, and suddenly all the other kids had them. And I don't know, it was quite a formative days, really. I did enjoy, I had a couple of friends there. And music was quite popular. I remember buying a Tonic suit, getting into Scar, the skinhead look with Scar. And that was kind of a big deal.
I mean, other people I've talked to about going to boarding school, they've sort of mentioned that they felt on their first day, they felt a little bit abandoned. that the umbilical cord was cut at a very early age in some sense. Do you think that was something for you, or did you really hold the connection to your mother because you were only there on a weekly basis?
Yeah, it was a gentle introduction, I suppose. But there was a feeling of being like, get on with it. I mean, my mother's Scottish, you know, McNeish. They'd leave the babies on the side of the hill, and the ones that managed to come back would be kept, and the others were cast aside. She's quite tough, my mother. But it was when I went to, my mother then ended up very quickly remarrying my stepfather, who they're still together, and they're almost in their 90s, Barry. And Barry was the opposite of my father. He was mid-management, provincial, worked at a printing factory in Slough as a mid-range manager. But very stable and secure. But he was difficult. He had three kids and he could be really grumpy, and he didn't have the charm of my dad, but he had a lot of other qualities. I mean, he could be a bit of a bully as well, but he also had a bit of a heart underneath it. But I feel really fortunate now that I had two very different and very strong male role models as growing up, as a kid. I mean, because many kids today don't know their fathers. And actually, my dad didn't know his father that well because he died from the war early on. And my mother never knew her father growing up in Africa. And her mother was very strong, independent, a bit cold, sent her off to a Catholic boarding school in Kenya at the age of 6. Which she ran away from at the age of 7.5, 8, and found her way back to my grandmother's house 500 miles away. And I mean, they didn't know any different, really. And it was that generation. But my father was very warm, and my mother. But still, they were quite tough in many other ways. Going to Kingham Hill in Oxford, my mother had garnered a bursary as a single mum. I mean, at the time, I was living in a two-bedroom flat in Paddington with 5 kids. And me and my stepbrother were up in the attic. It was right at the top of this old Victorian block of houses, flats. And, you know, that wasn't sustainable. So my mother managed to get me a bursary, and I went to Kingham, and I'd already done a year at a comprehensive, actually, in Kilburn, St. Augustine's, which was pretty rough school.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You know, there were stabbings and it was quite violent. And it was actually, strangely, but not really, I found myself in a minority group as a white kid because predominantly the school was black and Asian. And that was an interesting experience, growing up in a predominantly black cultured school. So I got really good at sport and I got into music. And, you know, I made a few friends. I was starting to get into music a bit. But I was also getting into problems, and there were gangs, and I got caught shoplifting a few times, which was kind of part of a gang thing. And my mother was freaking out. But I was also learning music. I started to learn trombone and French horn and reed. But that attracted a lot of bullying, actually, on the bus on the way back often. And I found various mechanisms to cope with that. But still, it was okay. But then I was shunted off after a year to Kingham. And actually, that was great because at St. Augustine's, there were like 35 kids in my class. I don't think one of my teachers ever spoke to me once. I mean, I wasn't getting an education. And if you were seen to be engaging with the education, you'd get bullied for it. So I didn't get any education there. And I came to Kingham, you know, really at the bottom of the class. But at Kingham, there were suddenly classes of 15 kids and very committed, dedicated teachers. It was a Quaker school, had a Christian ethos, very light one. And two-thirds of the kids were bursary kids, or lost fathers in the art war, RAF kids. And so it wasn't like a Harrow or an Eton where there was fagging and stuff like that. All the kids were from, you know, challenging, difficult family backgrounds. And they were as confused as everyone else. I feel lucky I didn't go at 12 in the first year, because I think the kids are a little too vulnerable at that age to be able to stand up for themselves. And I'm sure some of the teachers there were a little bit sadistic and there was abuse going on. But there was generally the younger kids that would be picked on for that. So I didn't get any of that. But nevertheless, I was in a very authoritarian, you know, place. I was away from home.
How important was that to you culturally to be, or creatively, I should say, to be at that school? Because, you know, I've heard you talk about before a particular teacher, and how this teacher sort of gave you some impetus in terms of your creative, you know, know-how and knowledge and music.
Well, no, I had two good teachers there that were really good. David Shepherd, who was a housemaster and an English teacher, and he actually got me into literature and got me reading. And David Carpanini, my art teacher, who was this magnificent Welsh painter who reluctantly got into education. He's now a member of the Royal Academy. He's an academician, and he's an amazing painter. And I learned a lot from him, and I still draw upon that with what I do with production today, because he basically let you get on with it, and he'd let you bring records in and play records. And then he'd sort of say, oh, that's interesting. And if you needed some guidance or advice, you'd come over and say something positive, you know, never say anything negative. And then he'd let you get on with it. And even if it was completely not his thing, he'd be very encouraging. I thought that was amazing. And I really connected with him. But I connected with a lot of the lessons. I did get an education. I mean, it didn't work very hard, but I came out with 6 O-levels, I think. And I got accepted to an art school at 16 when I left after my O-levels, rather than having to go through my A-levels. With a letter from David and my 6 O-levels, I got accepted to Wimbledon and Chelsea, I think. But I ended up joining a band. But I think those few years were, yeah, pivotal for me. And, you know, I thought it was an amazing experience in hindsight. I'm sure I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if I hadn't had that experience. What it really gave me was independence and confidence at an early age. My mum was a bit kind of, I remember coming back. I actually had a chemistry teacher who I said, can you teach me how to play folk guitar? Because I didn't have guitar lessons. And he ran this sort of Christian folk meeting, Crusaders meeting every Sunday. He said, okay, I'll teach you guitar, but you've got to come to the Christian folk meetings and play along for the kids. So I said, yeah, all right, I'll do that. So I did that for a year and I learned how to play guitar pretty much. And I immediately started writing songs and formed a little band. And then I went back to my music teacher, and who was very clever. He was one of the Sunday Times crossword writers, you know, and he very articulate. I said, look, I don't really want to do the grades and all that, but I've learned this guitar chords. I'm writing songs, played them a couple. Can you just teach me how to play these songs on the piano, these chords on the piano? And I'll be able to start writing songs on the piano. He goes, I wouldn't normally do this, but because you've done that, I'll do it. So he gave me a couple of lessons. Immediately started writing songs on the piano and playing the piano. So I think I was pretty resourceful. But also I was in a place where I had time and space to really get into things, you know. And it's so much so, I thought it was so good. I mean, I know some of my friends didn't have such a good time and, you know, would never go back, let alone send their kids there. But I actually sent my kids, I sent my son there, I tried to get my daughter to go there. I found myself as a single parent, solo parent in London for about 6-7 years. And that was really, really, really challenging. This must have been, you know, about 7-8 years ago, I suppose. And I thought maybe boarding school. Actually, I'd sent Jake to, my daughter's gone through Steiner School throughout her life. And my son started there. So I was determined to give him an alternative experience to the schooling I had.
Hey, y'all, it's your girl, Keke Palmer. I'm proud to introduce to you my new podcast, Baby, This is Keke Palmer, exclusively on Amazon Music. I'm putting my friends, family, and some of the hottest experts in the hot seat to ask them the questions that have been burning on my mind. What would former child stars be if they weren't actors? Is OnlyFans only bad? I want to know, so I asked my mama about it. These are the questions that keep me up at night, and I'm letting y'all all in on it. Come kick it with me and my weekly guests as we go down the rabbit hole and dive deep into my mind together. Listen to Baby, This is Keke Palmer, exclusively on Amazon Music.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
But you were also at school with Alex Peterson, weren't you? And also Guy Pratt, I think.
Yes, I was at school with Alex and Guy. And
I mean, that's quite amazing, really, that you have, you know, there's that breadth of talent in one school.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But I mean, with my son, with my son, Elliot, he was suddenly in the bottom of his class. And I had a teacher's meeting with this young Kiwi teacher. And he said, look, because he'd been to Steiner, they don't do academics till they're 7. He's behind. He's in the bottom quarter. And he said, I shouldn't tell you this, but we're pushed to just focus on the top 25% so we can get our stats up as teachers. I said, that's disgusting. He said, I don't agree with it, but that's the way it is. He said, if you can afford it, send him private because he won't get the attention here, because he's in the bottom quarter. I was a real slap in the face, but I appreciated his frankness. And that's when I started looking at Kingham. And he had a really good experience there as well. So, I mean, for some people, it was really good. I think it was, you know, it was pretty good for Alex as well. But if you, I'm reading Alex's autobiography at the moment, she did with Chris Needs. And it was tough me going through the Kingham years because he did go in at 12 and he had a very distant mother who'd run away from home and go back to the boarding school in the holidays, and he'd come to my mum's and stuff. And his mum didn't really want him around that much and was a bit mad, and yeah, had real mental health issues. But what he found in Kingham was a community and a family, actually. And the head teacher was amazing. And Noddy, we called him. And he was very caring. I ran away from school at one point and broke the school record for getting out for like 2 weeks without anyone knowing where I was, which absolutely freaked my mother out. I did ring her up after a few days. But my dad was totally cool. And he said, come back whenever you like, you know, take your time. when I went back, I said, I'm not going back there. And he goes, why are you about to do your O-levels? You might as well finish it. Otherwise, what are you going to do? And I said, okay, well, they have me. He said, yeah. So I went back and my headmaster took me in and he said, what was that all about? And I said, oh, I don't know. And I ended up sort of telling him about difficult problems I was having at home, my mum, my stepfather. And I looked up and he was looking at me with tears in his eyes. And he said, don't worry, you'll be all right here. We'll look after you. And he was a lovely guy. And I did get punished for running away. I'd actually had a sort of fifth form study block sort of study, which was great. And I'd abused my privilege by being caught smoking cigars and drinking rum in there one night by my housemaster, which is why I ran away. So I didn't get that back, but I had to do a month in the third year's sort of common room. And eventually I got it back before I left school. But I mean, I'm glad I went back and did those O-levels. And, you know, not only did Mr. Cooper, the headmaster, was very kind to me about it. I mean, I came back a sort of absolute returning hero for the other kids because I'd broken the school record. So, you know, I mean, my experiences were pretty good. It was weird because there were no girls there. Well, there were a couple of girl teachers. I had this one French teacher that was absolutely stunning. And that was odd, that repression of not being able to naturally engage and hang out with girls was odd. And I'm sure, you know, that's why I kind of made up for lost time with that when I left school. But like now, it's co-ed and there's girls there and, you know, I think it's a lot more healthy.
And that is it for part one of this podcast with youth. I'll see you for part two, where we look at his life as a producer.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.